Hey everyone, Cleon Wall here, and we've got a special treat for you this week. Before we release our final episode of Season 2 of Big Stories, where we will be sharing some of our favorite moments, we thought we'd impart to you one of our other fantastic podcasts from BYU Sports Nation and BYU Radio. It's called Deep Blue, and it dives into the real, raw, and inspiring stories behind BYU athletes and coaches. Jason Shepherd hosts the show, and in this episode, he sits down with former BYU football quarterback Max Hall. Max's story is powerful, from his glory days on the field to battling drug addiction and rebuilding his life. Now he's helping others do the same through his own recovery center. If you like what you hear, you can find even more Deep Blue episodes on the BYU Radio app or wherever you get podcasts. We hope you enjoy this special episode, Max Hall, Setting Others Free.
Get a deeper connection with the Cougars of BYU Sports.
God gives us a gift, and we use that gift until he takes it away.
Deep Blue.
Just sitting down afterward and being really tired and thinking like, wow, I just won the U.S. championship.
This is Deep Blue. Here's your host, Jason Shepherd.
Thanks for tuning in for a brand new episode of Deep Blue. This is the show where we get to know the person behind the number that you see on the field or the court. These are the true stories of BYU athletes from their own mouths. My guest today, the great Max Hall. Max, how are you? It's always good to talk to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, man. I appreciate you guys having me on. Life's crazy and busy, and I know it was hard even just finding a time to do this, but I enjoy this, and I enjoy what you guys do with the show and Deep Blue, and it was really cool being part of it. So things are good, man, but I'm glad to be back on with you guys.
Well, you said things are very busy, and I know a lot of what you're doing, but for those that maybe don't know what's keeping you busy these days, why don't you update everybody?
Yeah, sure. So I just finished my 10th season coaching here at ALA. And then my day job is athletic director. So I have all that going on, but, kids are getting older. Kids have games, kids have this, that. They're old enough now. I got to take them places on the weekends, and you know, it's just, life just seems to be going really fast. And sometimes I need to remind myself to slow down and enjoy the moment a little bit. But you know, between that and now, you know, college coaches are coming around the school a lot and to see the kids. And so it's just kind of random things that pop up throughout the day. But junior high football is going on right now. So my son Rex is an eighth grader. So I'm coaching him on the junior high team. So we got that going on. And, you know, it's just kind of day-to-day stuff. But when you really take a step back and look at it, I'm happy with where I'm at. I'm happy with, you know, how life is going. I just got to remember to slow down sometimes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, the most recent football season for you guys, 10-2 on the year, and you guys lost in the state semifinals. Is that right?
We did. So in Arizona, they have what they call an open division playoff. So they take the eight best teams in the state, between 6A is the highest, 5A is the next down, and they take the eight top teams in the state, and they do an open playoff for a true state champion. So we've been in that playoff the last 4 years. We won in the first round, and then we lost to Basha in the semifinals. Basha had a really good team, and it was tough because it was one of those games we kind of felt like we beat ourselves. We felt like we should have won, and just wasn't the case. So it was a tough way to end the year there. But probably one of, if not the best team we've ever had here at ALA since I've been here. And it's been fun to watch this program grow. And now we have more and more kids coming in that want to be a part of what we're doing, who want to buy into our mission and the values and the way that we do things. And so it's pretty cool to see people starting to want to be part of it and be part of a great culture, but also be part of an elite football program. So that's fun. And hopefully we can get back there next year and possibly win it. But it's going to be fun to see how this next team shapes out.
Well, and you're the offensive coordinator. So when you look at this offense, if you were to describe your offense, what type of offense do you guys run?
You know, that's always an interesting question, and people ask me that. I think my offense has a lot of, you know, spread tendencies to it. West Coast pass game. Nowadays, quick game has basically turned into RPO, So a lot of the quick game concepts are tagged off of the run game and RPO. And really, and I tell people all the time, it depends on what kind of players I have. So this last year I had two really good tight ends. So I ran a lot more double tight end sets and 12 personnel and stuff like that. So that was fun to kind of create that, which I haven't done a lot of in the past. So it's take what the defense gives you, man. It's fun because every week I feel like the game plan, the offense might look a little bit different based on what we're going to see. But at the end of the day, it is a spread. It's a West Coast pass game with, you know, RPO with your base, power counter, inside, outside zone stuff. So that's pretty much it. And then I just scheme it up every week and what I think works best. So it's a blast, man.
You know, I would imagine, you know, you're obviously somebody that can speak to this, the evolution of the offense, you know, every offense seems now to be catered towards whether it's realistic or not for the athletes to go to the NFL. It's all about preparing them for that type of offense and going against NFL defenses and things like that. How much has it evolved from a coaching standpoint in terms of the types of offenses that you're running?
No, it's evolved a lot. And even the type of quarterback you have has changed a lot. You know, it's no longer the, hey, I need a 6'5" kid who can throw the ball 80 yards and, you know, a lot of play action and pro style type stuff. You know, now everybody's spreading it out. The offensive coordinators now are really creative in some of the stuff they're doing. And it's fun to keep up with guys that I know and talk ball with them, but it's getting, I mean, defenses are getting better. So the offenses have to come up with new ways to do things. Right. And so the way that things are going is you're getting away from those traditional sets and you're getting more into, you know, maybe one tight end sets, you know, 11 personnel, but it's spread them out and kind of see how they line up. And then let's dictate the play based on what they're doing. So there's a lot of check with me's now. There's a lot of options for the quarterback to change the play. And you have to be able to do that so that you're not just kind of like calling a play and hoping that you see the look that you think you're going to get. Because if you don't, there has to be something else. So the quarterback preparation the stuff that I'm teaching my son as an eighth grader, I didn't learn until I was a senior in college. You know what I'm saying? Like I didn't know what an RPO was when I played. And then I went up to Canada. And in Canada, that's all they did was RPOs. And this is before anybody was doing it in the States. And I'm like, wait a second, it's a run play. I can't throw the ball. Like, that's against the rules, isn't it? And they go, so I learned a lot about the RPO game and the box and how to count it and how to read it when I was in the CFL. And it's been cool to just take all that I know and just kind of mold it into what we have. And then, focus on your players. You know, it's funny. You can scheme up the best all you want, but you know, there's that saying, it's more about the Jimmies and the Joes than the X's and the O's. Right. So, And I'm not talking about just studs. It's, are you preparing your athletes? Are you preparing your players to be able to be smart and process information and make good decisions? And so from the receivers to the quarterback to the center, and it's a lot of time, it's a lot of coaching, but when it comes together, it's beautiful, man. And it's what I love to do.
So not only are you a football coach, and you talked about, you know, coaching your kids and dealing with all of the family stuff that keeps you busy, you also have helped found Victory Recovery, which is an addiction recovery center. And obviously, I would assume most people know your story. For those that may not to the degree that we think they do, you're someone that was addicted to pain pills and you were able to come through that. So why go through the work of starting your own recovery center? Why was that important for you?
I think it was important because, you know, they always say if you're a 12-step guy, you know, the 12th step is, are you going to give back? Are you going to help other people? You know, once you kind of get yourself back right and get going, one of the things that keeps you on the right track is helping other people and talking about it, sharing your story. And so that's what we wanted to do. But selfishly, that just kind of keeps my head right. You know, when I see other people going through it and I'm able to help them, I remember, hey, I used to be there. I know what that feels like. I know what you're going through. And I think that's one of the biggest, benefits of being in the position I'm in is I've gone through the same thing. So people will listen. People will trust me because this is how I did it. And let me help you do it to get you back healthy.
Well, and I think it's something that we're taught is that when we're going through our own tough times, one of the best ways we can help ourselves is to serve other people. And it sounds like that's kind of the way that you viewed it as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's charity. It's Christ is what it is. It's giving back. It's at the end of the day, teaching people how to use the atonement. It's teaching people how to be able to look back up to God. And because when we're in our addictions, we don't want to look up. We want to keep our eyes down. We want to focus on ourselves. We want to be just leave me alone, leave me in my addiction. And so being able to open that back up, let other people back into your life, let God back into your life is one of the main points of it. You have to have a higher power, whatever that is, right? And so a lot of the people I work with are LDS. And so being able to use the atonement in recovery is pretty special, I think, and has its own unique qualities to it. So that's pretty cool how that goes hand in hand as well.
Well, and addiction is such a serious topic. It affects countless people. And certainly there are many different addictions that people can have. So what is it that helped you the most to achieve your sobriety? Is there one thing specifically, or was it sort of a combination of it all?
Oh man. Yeah. It's a lot, but I think I can give you the short answer. Is what it comes down to is, you know, when you fall to addiction, when I fell to addiction, I was broken. I was not the same guy. I was totally in a different mindset. And, you lose self-respect, self-love. You hate what you're doing. You can't help it. It's scary. You don't want to stop, but you know, you have to. And so there's all these emotions that go through you. And the first motivation I had was family. You know, I need to do this for my kids, for my wife, for my family, and I need to get this done. And that worked. It kind of got me going. But what I realized is at the end of the day, I got to make a decision of who I want to be and what I want to do. And if I don't want to be an addict and I want to overcome this and I want to go achieve other things in my life, then I have to make a decision. And once I make the decision, you got to burn the boats, as they say, right? There is no going back. Once I say, okay, I'm ready to get sober, you have to get to a place to where you are willing to do anything, everything, whatever is asked of you, you say yes and do it. And even if it's go jump in the cold lake, you know, like go do it. Because if you don't get to the point to where you're ready just to completely not fight it and do everything that people ask you to do, because you know, that's what you need to do to get sober. And I'm doing it because I want it, not for somebody else. And I think that's what really kind of got my recovery and kind of took it to the next level, is when that self-respect and self-love and self-care, and when I liked myself again, now I was able to be a good dad again and a good husband and coach football and do all the things I'm doing. But I had to get my own head right first. And so that's the hardest thing that people don't realize. And then you get people who don't want to get sober. Yeah, they're an addict and they have no motivation. They have no family. They have no desire to change. And those are the tough ones. Those are the ones that get really dark. But I've seen people come out of it. It's just when that person makes the decision that I'm done, now we can start the recovery and move forward. But there's so many people who have told me they've made it, but they haven't. They're not all in. So when I say burn the boats, we're all in, that's when it starts. And so it took me... I mean, even when I got out of recovery, it still took me a while to flip that switch, right? And it was probably a year of white knuckling and trying to figure out what works for me. And am I, you know, what do I do? Who do I see? Who do I talk to? Do I get a sponsor? Do I go to meetings? What am I going to do? Took me a year to figure that all out and come up with a plan and a path that worked for me. Everybody's recovery is different. There's no one deal to do it. And so that's what we were doing. We were helping people find their path and what works for them. And so, for me, I had to take the mentality, the competitiveness, the great qualities that I had that made me a great football player. And I had to learn how to change that from football into Max as a person, as a husband, as a father, as a, you know, follower of Christ. And that's where I think things changed. When I figured out how to do that and use this the same way that I was dedicated and just viciously wanted to be the best at football. Yeah. I need to do that for myself. So that for me is what really got me sober.
Do you still feel a connection to that guy, or because of the work you've done and the time that has passed, does that almost feel like a completely different person?
It's a different person. I don't even, I've gotten to the point now. I mean, I'm not a big day counter. I know some people are, but I mean, I think we're 11 years now since it happened. And I've gotten to the point to where I don't forget it. I don't pretend like it never happened. I own that. But that person is so far in the rearview mirror, and I don't want to focus on the past. I know he's there, and I know I could go back to that if I don't keep on the right, you know, path and make the right decisions. But I don't need to focus on it. And, you know, there's a lot of people in recovery who will go to a meeting, and, you know, every meeting they go to, they say, "Hi, I'm Max. I'm an alcoholic," or "I'm an addict." I got a little different perspective, and so, and I'll get criticized for this, but I really don't care. My thing is self-talk. And if I wake up every day and say that I'm an addict, I'm going to be an addict, you know. But if I wake up every day and say that, no, I'm Max and I'm sober and I'm a great dad and I have self-confidence, and how you talk to yourself is a big deal. And so again, that's just another path that might work for someone else. But for me, that's in the past. And I'm not going to focus on that because I can't change it. I've learned from it. I know what to do going forward, and I'm going to apply that going forward. No reason to dwell on it, because if I dwell on it, I'm going to get depressed, and I'm going to remember all the bad things that I did and all the ways that I acted. And I don't want that. I want to look forward to the future and focus on the things that I need to do to keep getting better.
Isn't that, well, though, exactly what repentance is all about? I mean, because we're taught that, you know, if we ask Heavenly Father to forgive us, and that we repent of what we've done, you know, and He takes that from us, it's not that we're not going to remember it, but the feeling that we had and the self-loathing of it, that part of it's gone. We know we've moved past it. But we'll still remember it because it will help us in the future to avoid it again.
Exactly. Exactly. And we have to learn from our, it's like being a quarterback. Okay. You threw a pick. What'd you learn? Okay. Next play. Don't keep thinking about the pick. It's the same thing. You made a mistake. Own it. Fess up to it. Learn what you have to do to overcome it and get better. And then leave it behind. You know, trust that God's going to forgive you, that He really does forgive you. And so it's kind of, when I say leave it behind, it means remember, like, you know what it is, but I'm not focusing on it. I know where it's at, if that makes sense. It's kind of hard to explain, but I need to focus on who I'm going to be going forward. Because in my opinion, Heavenly Father knows we're going to make mistakes. Heavenly Father knows what we're going through and that things are going to be hard. And to me, my relationship with Him is, He doesn't care about the mistakes. He cares about what I do about it, because without mistakes, we can't learn. That's the whole reason why the whole plan of salvation exists and why we're here, right? Is so that we can learn. And I tell people all the time, I could give you a playbook and you could memorize that thing, which God has given us a playbook, right? And He asks us to read it and study it. But as much as you read it and study it, if I gave you a playbook and then said, okay, go play, no practice, no reps, no nothing, you're not going to know what to do. Yeah, you see it on paper, but when it actually hits you in real life, that's a different story. When you got the rush coming at you and you got to stand in there and make the throw, that's different. You learn different. So Heavenly Father knows that, and He's going to throw things at us, and He wants to see how we handle it and how we learn from it. So that's my perspective on it, is I'm not a bad person because I made a mistake. I made a bad decision. Okay, what are you going to do about it? And that's kind of where my mind goes, and kind of my relationship with Heavenly Father is that's how we do it. And that works for me.
For those that have not seen the Your Deep Blue that was a couple of years ago now on BYU TV, I certainly highly recommend everybody go check that out. It was fantastic. But for those that have seen it, they certainly know the role your wife played in this whole situation with your recovery and sort of turning things around. Where would you be right now, not just in recovery, but in life in general, without your wife right now?
I'd be back over here behind the dumpster probably, you know, just waking up right now is probably what I would be doing. I'd be lost. I'd be lost because Kenzie was a huge, not just motivation, and you need motivation. Everybody needs motivation maybe to kind of get going. But until you have a passion inside of you to do something, it's not going to work. I can give you the best rah-rah speech in the world and you go out there and, you know, lay an egg in the first quarter. It's like, you know, that motivation went away. It's got to come from in here. It's got to come from passion. And Kenzie helped me find that. And that's what was big about her. She didn't give up on me. She stayed with me. And she said, let's fight this thing. I'm with you. I got your back. And that gave me some confidence to go ahead and try to do some of the things that I didn't want to do. But I said, I need to do these things. And so she just, as a supporter, as a wife, always had my back, always was there for me. And that's a big deal to have somebody like that. And especially your wife who didn't leave, didn't give up, didn't criticize, didn't ridicule, but said, I love you and let's fix it. Let's fight because that's what we have to do. And so she, and I could go on for an hour about the things that she's done, but for her to work on herself and to learn about it and not just read books and get counseling on how to handle me and how to handle the situation is just, she put her head down and said, let's go. And that made me like, okay, I'm gonna put my head down and go. Like having a partner, it's like having a workout partner. You work out harder when you got a partner, right? And so that's what it was for me.
How's the Achilles doing, by the way? You tore the Achilles in the BYU alumni game a little while ago. Is it fully healed? Everything good?
Oh, dude, I tore that Achilles, had surgery. 2 weeks later, I was dunking again. Like, it's no big deal, man. No, the Achilles is doing good. I think I'm finally to a place to where I can run and I don't think about it. Like, I don't think like, oh, my Achilles. It was like that for, it was probably 8 months after surgery when I was kind of starting to walk around, but it took at least a year before I wasn't like worried about it snapping again. So it's doing good. My days of church basketball and some of that are over. But there's a couple things in life that I want to be able to do. I love to ride my mountain bike. I want to be able to play golf. I want to play pickleball with my daughter, who is a phenomenal pickleball player. And I want to be able to move around, throw the ball with my kids. So it's funny. As life goes on, you think more about longevity than you think about like performance right now. It's like, I want to be able to move 10 years from now. So taking care of your body and your mental health as well, just kind of keeps you on track. So it's doing great. It's it kind of aged me a little bit, but it's doing fine now.
So I do want to bring it back one more to your recovery. Obviously, usually in a situation like that, doctors will prescribe painkillers after surgery. You chose not to go that route for obvious reasons. And I don't want to maybe make this sound overly dramatic, but how big of a moment was that for you to realize that you were in a place where you could make that decision?
Yeah, it was funny because there's a tool that we teach people, and that tool is you need to be ready for the answer before you get asked the question. So I know in my head, if I ever have to have surgery or if I have an injury, the answer is no, I can't take, I can't, I'm not going to. So don't think about it. Don't dwell on it. Don't think maybe, I can fake some pain. Like that's the addict talking to you. You have to say, look, I'm done. I'll figure it out. I'll endure the pain. I'll take some ibuprofen. I'll do whatever. All right. So as soon as that happened and I knew I had to get surgery, I actually had people come up to me right away. Like, hey, how are you going to handle this? And I already had the answer. I said, I'll be fine. It's going to hurt. It's fine. I've hurt before. Like I'll get through it. It'll be a moment. And so, but here's how the adversary works. This is how addiction works. We go to the doctor's appointment, the nurse, she's like, okay, we're going to prescribe you this, Percocet. And I said, and I brought my wife with me on purpose. Right. So it's just a tool, even though I probably would have been fine. I want to make sure. So Kenzie, come with me, listen to me tell the nurse that I'm not going to get this stuff. Okay. We're going to be good. Well, day after surgery, I'm in pain. I'm in pain and I'm gutting through it. My phone dings. I get a text message. Your prescription of Percocet is ready at the pharmacy. And I'm sitting there like, Kenzie doesn't know about this. She thinks that I told him no.
Yeah.
And there was a moment, right? I had a moment where I was like, ooh, no one would know. That's the addict talking. But I have so much time and I've worked on myself and I have the tools that I can identify it right away and be like, nope. Nice try. Hey, Kenzie, look at this text message I just got. Now that I've told somebody, now the obsession of it kind of goes away. Well, I already told her about it. There's no way I can do it. So that's just a little tool, a little trick that we have to learn as addicts to keep our mind in the right space and not let that addict mentality take over.
We're talking with the great Max Hall here on the Deep Blue Podcast. And the theme of this is changes throughout our life and how the decisions that we make after the changes and where it takes us. And we're going to get into a few more. Yes, we are going to talk a little bit more football. In fact, we're going to get into that when we come back. We're going to take a quick break. We'll have more with Max Hall right after this. You're listening to the Deep Blue Podcast on BYU Radio. You're listening to the Deep Blue Podcast here on BYU Radio. I'm your host, Jason Shepherd. My guest today is former BYU quarterback, Max Hall. And look, Max, we in the first part of the podcast, you know, we talked about your road to recovery. And obviously that was a big decision that you made to get yourself in the position that you are today. And so what I really wanted to do for the rest of the podcast is talk about some of the other big decisions in your life and some of the changes that you went through. And so let's bring it back to football, because I'm going to assume that because of knowing how competitive you are and knowing how good you were at the position of playing quarterback, I'm going to assume that's something that you strive for most of your life. At what point did you realize this was what I wanted to do?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So it's funny. I grew up as a kid. I was a basketball guy. My first love was basketball. And played starting as a little kid. And, you know, back then the club scene wasn't as big as it is, but like AAU was around. And, you know, I was on a couple different teams. And I thought I was going to go to ASU and play basketball. That's what I thought. I wanted to go to ASU and then I was going to go play for the Phoenix Suns, right? That's what I thought I was going to do as a kid. And then, you know, I played my first year of tackle football, I think when I was 12. And I hated it. I remember I came home from the first day of practice in tears, sitting in the hot tub, you know, just like, because they made us run and hit. And I'm just like, I don't like this, Dad. Like, I'm not doing this. And Dad's like, no, we signed up. You started. You're finishing it. Like, you're going to do it. Well, the next day at practice, I'm a receiver. And the coach is like, hey, we need to find a quarterback. Can anybody here throw? Well, I was also a baseball player. I was a pretty good pitcher. I had a good arm. I said, well, I pitch in baseball and I'll try. So he goes, all right, Hall, get up there, throw a slant route. And I took a three-step drop, threw a slant route and played quarterback ever since. So that's how I became a quarterback. And then it really was probably my sophomore year in high school where I'm like, oh, man, I might be a better quarterback than I am a two-guard, you know, and I'm not sure if I'm going to get the height to play basketball. And turns out I can spin a football better and I can shoot a basketball. So I started getting a lot of recognition in football, started getting some offers and you know, ended up just kind of taking off and fell in love with it. So, that's kind of how I came. And then, you know, it was still, I want to go to ASU. You know, I that's my uncle, my grandpa's jerseys are retired there. I went to the ASU games growing up. I want to go to ASU. And so I went there and was there for a semester. I left on my mission. And when I came home, I knew I couldn't go back to ASU and I needed to put myself in a better position, and BYU was the answer. So I got home and BYU said, hey, we still got a scholarship for you if you want to come to BYU. And I said, well, I'll come up on a visit, went up on a visit. And as I was sitting in a fireside, that they were giving before the game. I don't know, does the team still do the firesides the night before the game sometimes?
Sometimes.
Yeah, so we used to do it a lot more, and I know they do it still once in a while, but I'm sitting there, that fireside, and I'm watching the players talk, and Coach Mendenhall gets up and talk, and I remember I kind of, me and my dad looked at each other at the same time, and he's like, "You're supposed to be here." And I said, "Okay." So that's how I ended up transferring to BYU. It had nothing to do with football, had nothing to do with what quarterbacks were there, or I just wanted to be at BYU. And I wanted to play football at BYU. And so I worked my tail off and got an opportunity. I got to learn from John Beck, you know, from a year, and got an opportunity and played. So that's kind of, it was probably like my sophomore, junior year where I'm like, dude, I think my career is in football. And that's when I made the switch.
I think we feel like there's got to be these just gigantic moments that set us up on this course that we were destined for. But you talk about the fact that you were playing receiver and just on a whim, like, hey, can anybody play quarterback? I mean, had that question not been asked, your life could be completely different. Or if you're not at that fireside, maybe you don't have that prompting to go to BYU. So it's these small things that if we're not paying attention to or there at the right time – I mean, you talk about decisions, it could look completely different for you.
I mean, what if I stayed at ASU? What did that look like? Where would my life have gone from there? And it's no secret, ASU is a big party school. You know what I mean? And I needed to get out of that environment, and I needed to be in a better one. And so who knows where my life would have went? Well, I don't know if I'd have played at ASU or if I'd have never played and just partied the whole time I was there. I don't know. You know, it's like BYU didn't have to reach out when I came home. Why did they reach out? There was something there that was special. There was something that – there's a reason why I needed to be there. And it just happened. I feel bad for some of these kids nowadays trying to get to college and get a scholarship. For me, it just kind of – it happened. And you know, looking back, I think I know some of the reasons why. And it wasn't just to play football. It's what I did for other people. It's what I learned. I ended up meeting my wife in the process of all this. So it just goes together. And I always, you know, when I talk, it's like, my life is like the Book of Mormon, man. You know what I mean? It's like, I do good. And then, you know, I get comfortable, and then, you know, the Book of Mormon's like this. Yeah. They're either doing really good or they're really bad. Right.
Yeah.
And I'd like, dude, I got to even this out. I gotta stay up here a little bit. Right. So it's being at BYU, I think, was one of the biggest blessings in my life. It did more for me than I think I did for BYU.
You mentioned going and being there with John Beck and you were able to sit and watch Beck that 2006 season. And I'm curious, from your perspective, everybody wants to play, everybody wants to be out there. How much of your collegiate success do you believe can be traced back to that year that you had to watch and learn?
It's the best thing that could have happened to me. So when I was at ASU, I was on the travel squad. I was the third string quarterback, and I held the clipboard all practice. I got to go to the games, but I wasn't getting any reps. When I got to BYU, I was ineligible to play my first year. I went to BYU knowing I couldn't play the first year. I didn't care. And so what that allowed me to do was run the scout team. So every single day I got to go against the best defense in the Mountain West. That was with Kelly Papinga and Brian Kill and Nixon and Criddle and all these guys, that amazing defense. And I got to go against them every day in practice, and I got better and better. And then that spring, when I had an opportunity to compete for the job, I was ready because I followed John Beck everywhere he went, and I soaked up everything he had to say and everything he did. And I watched how hard he worked, and I watched how he trained, how he coached, how he managed his players. And I learned a lot from him. And then you add in Brandon Doman, who believed in me, who told me I was going to be great, that I could be as good as I wanted to be, and I'm going to help you get there. And I had people believing in me. I had people that you know, helped me get to where I was at. I didn't just become that. I had guys like John and Brandon and Bronco and these guys who helped me become that. And then obviously I had to go do it. I had to put in the work too, but learning from those guys was invaluable. And so the reps I got, learning, and then having a coach that believed in me and knew me and knew how to coach me and motivate me was, you know, Coach Doman is responsible for my success at BYU more than I think anybody. And that's pretty special to be able to say that.
Well, you were certainly ready to roll when the reins of the offense were given to you. What did that moment mean? Can you articulate what it meant to you when it was your show and you were finally able to get on the field?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, just, and I'll go through this quick, but going into spring, I thought I was the next dude up. You know, John and Jason Beck are graduating. They tell me that how much they like me, next man up, right? Well, they brought in like 3 JC transfers, a couple kids got home from their mission. All of a sudden the quarterback room's like 8 dudes. It was supposed to be like 3. And I'm like, what the heck? I thought I was supposed to be the guy. Like, why are you bringing all these guys? And competition, right? And it made me better. So I remember at the end of spring, we were doing it off touchdown drives. That's who the starter was going to be, right? And I think it was 21 touchdown drives through spring. And the next closest was 7. So I'd done what I needed to do to win the job. And then when they did finally name me the starter, kind of going into the summer and into the season, that's when everything mindset-wise changed. And this is what I learned, not right away, but as I did it, is it's not so much about how I prepared myself. I know I'm going to prepare myself. Like I'm an addict. I'm crazy. I was addicted to football. Like I couldn't get enough of it. I was going to watch film and work. I was going to outwork anybody. But I got to prepare my teammates. I got to get them ready to go because I'm only as good as my teammates, right? And so preparing them and doing everything with them and creating relationships, I was able, for whatever reason, I had the quality of being able to take a group of guys and elevate them and take a group of guys and they believe that we're going to win because I got Pitta and I got Colley and I got Harvey. They got me. And there's this feeling of we put in so much work together, we can beat anybody. And we had an invincible feeling. We thought we could beat anybody. And I think that's what made that team so great. I wish we could have played more at a conference games, mm-hmm. you know, playing in the Mountain West. I would have liked to have played, you know, not playing San Diego State and Wyoming all the time. I wish we could have played some bigger games, which we got to, and got to play Oklahoma and Pac-10 teams. But I think that team was good enough to compete at a little higher level. But definitely a special couple of years there, man. It was a great time.
Well, in 2007, and this is probably selfish on my part because it's one of my favorite plays, and I just happened to be on the sideline there. It was earlier in my career. So I got to witness it. I mean, the catch was right in front of me. The 4th and 18 to Austin Colley, obviously leading to the victory over the University of Utah. Yeah. From a football standpoint, where does that game and that moment rank for you?
There's 3 moments in my career that stand out, and I have a hard time ranking them sometimes. The 4th and 18 play was special because it was my sophomore year, it was my first time playing Utah. We're losing at home. I'm not playing well, and it's games on the line, right? And you could feel going into that drive some doubt. You could feel it. You could just feel like, are we really going to go the length of the field and however many minutes were left? It wasn't like 1 minute, but it was getting towards the end of the game. I can't remember how much time. And first down, second down, third down, I had taken a sack. We're 4th and 18. And I'm like, crap. And I look over at the sideline. And Coach and I, if you know Coach and I, he's just Coach and I. Like, he's awesome, but he's Coach and I. And he's just like glaring at me like this. And he goes like this. He gives me a fist. That's all he gives me, which means a go route. Didn't give me a formation or nothing. So I'm like, okay, let's go Trey right. Let's go 4 verts. And at the last second, I tagged Austin on a little stutter, like a stutter go. And if you ask Austin, he's like, that was a stupid call because they're not going to bite on a stutter go, you know, on 4th and 18. I'm like, do it anyway, right? Like, do what I tell you to do. So he runs it. But as he stutters, I get out of the pocket and the DB's eyes go to me and he goes right by him. And I had a separated shoulder in that game. I had separated my throwing shoulder at grade 3 separation the week before versus Wyoming. So that throw, Jason, that took everything I had to throw that ball about 40 yards. Some people don't know that I played that game with a separated shoulder. Like my collarbone's almost sticking out of my skin. And so everything I had, and when Austin caught that, it was like game over. Like, and we hadn't scored yet, but it's game over. The place, that play, when Austin caught that ball, that's the loudest, in my opinion, the loudest I ever felt that stadium. It's like I had 100 speakers around me and just the vibration and you can't hear. And it's like the place is shaking almost. It was just like the adrenaline rush you got from that was just unbelievable. And so that was special, right? And then you got my senior year, you got two special moments. You got the win against Oklahoma, which probably is my signature win, you would say. And then obviously the overtime pass to Andrew, got to be number one. I mean, I don't, when you throw an overtime pass against your rival to win the game, it's, I mean, but Jason, it easily, that 4th and 18, I could have gotten sacked.
Right.
That overtime play, I threw that ball into double coverage. It could have gotten tipped and we may not have scored. It's like when you bring up these little things that if they just went a little bit different, things change. And then I pop up after the game and all of a sudden become like a legend at BYU because I popped off after the Utah game. It's like people love me or hate me for that. And I look back at it and I think it's funny. You know, it's just at the time it was so intense and so serious. And now I cheer for Utah when they're not playing for BYU. I actually, one of my quarterbacks that played for me just walked on at Utah. I have another quarterback that played for me last year who signed with BYU. So I'm going to have a quarterback at Utah and a quarterback at BYU. And I might have to wear a blue shirt with a spot of red on it or something for my guy at Utah. But those three moments are the ones that I remember the most very vividly. And, you know, having the field rush after that overtime game and people grabbing me and hoisting me up. And I just, you dream of that as a kid. And so for that to come true for me, I just super blessed, man, just super happy with how things worked out.
Is the "I hate Utah" comment, is that what's brought up to you most?
It was for a while. And, you know, even some of my kids and players would find the clip on YouTube and pull it up, be like, "Coach, look at you." Like, you know, and it's kind of died down. Sometimes when I'm in Utah, you know, I'll get a "we hate them too," you know, it's one of those things. Uh-huh. And I think it's calmed down. I think I take pictures with people wearing "I hate Max Hall" shirts. It's funny. Like, in my opinion, it's funny, you know?
Quite frankly, Max, I mean, and I think you've probably experienced this, that also helps diffuse the situation because there are a lot of people that really didn't like that. But when you're able to have fun with it and then you have fun with Utah fans, it makes you even more endearing because it diffuses the entire situation.
Right. And that's what I wanted to do. I don't hate everything about Utah. You know, that came out of my mouth and instantly I said, "Crap, shouldn't have said that." All right. You know, it was more directed towards some fans that were being jerks to me and my family after the game. Right. So, but it was personal at the time because my family was involved. And people say that I lie about it and that never happened. Fine. You want to say that I lied about it? I'm not going to make up that I walked out of the locker room and what I saw. But so it was personal. But now that a couple years have passed, I look back, I go, it's kind of funny, you know, and it's at the end of the day, it's football. It's not the most important thing in the world. It's great. I love it. I'm passionate about it. It's a big part of who I am. There's other things that are more important, and relationships and treating other people and overcoming obstacles. We got to stick together on that. Yeah, we can cheer against each other, but at the end of the day, we're brothers and sisters, man. And who wins the BYU Utah game? Does it really matter? Does it really matter that much? So that's kind of where you get to in life.
What are the most important lessons, whether it's from your life experiences, from your playing days, what are those lessons that you feel are most important to pass on to your athletes?
I think that's a great question because football, in my opinion, is one of the best ways to teach valuable life lessons. You know, football's hard. You train year round for it to, you know, in high school, you're guaranteed 10 games. And you train, let's say, 300 days a year to play in 10 games. And so those games are so special. They're so you get up for them, like they're unique. Anytime you get a chance to play a football game, it's special, right? And so that's why there's so much emotion involved in football and everything and the physicality of it. And then teamwork and leadership and dedication and everything that you can learn in that is great. And I got really good at it in football. The key is being able to do it in life. How do I take overcoming adversity in football, which might be we keep jumping off sides or I can't complete a pass, you know, overcoming that adversity at least teaches you how to do it. But it's a lot harder in life to overcome an addiction or people get a divorce, or they lose a child, or they're suffering from depression, or they're whatever. That's harder to do than to go back the next series and complete a football or not jump off sides. Does that make sense what I'm saying? Yeah. But at least you learn it. And then it's like, okay, well, to overcome that, I had to refocus. You know, I had to motivate myself. I had to get a team, my team together and ready to go. So that's what I do in life. I have a team of people that are around me that I love and that I trust that can hold me accountable if need be. And I have people that I can rely on, just like I relied on my teammates when I played, because I can't do it alone. And that was one of the hardest things to realize, is Max Hall can't do it by himself. As mentally tough as I thought I was, can't. You need a team. And that's probably the biggest thing that I learned going forward, is you need people around you that want you to be successful. And if you can, like Chad Lewis's book, Surround Yourself with Greatness, right? When you surround yourself with the right people, you'll be amazed with how your life changes.
Max, I cannot thank you enough for being willing to do this. This was a thrill for me. Like I said, I covered your career, but you know, I've also been a fan of yours. I've had an opportunity to interview you lots of times, over the years. But I really appreciate you being willing to do this and to talk about the things that you did. Whether you see yourself as an inspiration or not, you certainly are. And I hope you know that in what your story can do for a lot of other people. So thank you so much for being willing to share it. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that means a lot to me. Thank you. And, you know, I've talked about my story a lot, but it doesn't get any easier. You know, I could probably get through it without crying a little bit better, but those emotions are still there. They're still real for me. I still, the emotions of shame and guilt will come up. The emotions of regret come up. And it just kind of is a reminder for me that I'm not going back there, right? And so for someone like you to say, you know, that it's helping other people and it's inspiration, that means the world to me, because I don't know. I try my best. I do my best. And if it really does help somebody, the gratification from that is as good as it gets. So thank you, Jason. I appreciate you having me on and you guys making this work, and kind of the whole Deep Blue thing that we did. I can't tell you how many people just loved what you guys did and how you did it. And a lot of compliments to you guys on what you're doing. And I haven't seen all of them, but I've seen some of your other ones, and I just think it's fantastic. So you guys keep doing what you're doing. I'm glad we got to do this, even though I was kind of had a crazy morning, and this was good for me, kind of reset me. And you know, I appreciate you taking the time to do it.
Well, I appreciate it. It was an absolute thrill for me. Thanks again, Max. I appreciate it.
You got it. Thank you.
All right. My name is Jason Shepherd. Ben Hall produced this episode. Deep Blue's senior producer is Cleon Wall. You can download and subscribe to Deep Blue on all podcast platforms, or find all episodes on the BYU Radio app. Deep Blue is a production of BYU Radio.